Costs to originate keep rising, even with more technology in the industry. The problem is the core platform. A new LOS can re-architect the process around data, not humans moving paper files. Vesta has built this LOS, and you can learn more at vesta.com. Welcome, everyone. My guest today is James Dwiggins, co-founder and CEO of Next Home and the host of the Real Estate Insiders Unfiltered podcast, to talk about the commission lawsuits and how he thinks NAR should pressure lawmakers to make some much-needed changes in the wake of the settlements. James, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
I'm very excited to have you here. It's always fun to have another podcast host on because I'm like, who knows where this will go. Also, just you've talked so much about this. Of course, one of the reasons that we're having you on, you're going to be speaking at the gathering in April, our big event on the commission lawsuit topic. So I want to get into that, but just really excited to have you here and talk about a little bit, give a preview of that, kind of what's going on. I think it's interesting because way back in September, before it was on most people's radar, of course, we had you on for a 10-minute talk where you were talking about the commission lawsuits, and I was listening to that again in preparation for this. And one of the things you said then was like, NAR should settle. NAR should absolutely settle. It's going to be really bad if they don't. And I was like, wow, they should have really listened to you at that point.
Well, and they did, in fairness. So I think that, I have a lot of contacts in lots of places, it's not that NAR hasn't wanted to or hasn't been in discussions with them. It's just timing and lots of other things. But it naturally, I thought, was going to go to a settlement, and obviously that's what happened. So
Yep. No, really prescient. So, give us a little bit of background. Next Home is a different kind of real estate company. You guys have more than 600 franchises. Different way of doing business. Maybe give us just a few minutes of understanding about what makes you guys different.
So we started franchising in January of 2015, so it's a fairly new organization. We sort of wanted to turn it on its head a little bit. We looked at the future of the industry being smaller. We think there'll be a lot less agents in the business long term. Obviously, I think some of those predictions are going to come true. And we also wanted franchising to be a little bit just looked at differently than how it was in the past. So our business model is a little bit different than other companies in that most of our offices are smaller in size. We're not focused on agent count, but more quality over quantity. We also operate our franchise where you're not required to have a brick and mortar location. So that's been part of our model since inception, was keep your overhead down, allow the brokerage to be more profitable. You don't need desks for all these agents. Half of them are never in the office anyway. Actually, probably 80% of them now aren't in the office anyway. And our model was just designed about very heavy tech. So my background and my business partner's background is from the tech sector. So we've owned and operated some prop tech companies, as well as being in the industry for a very long time. So we have our own engineering design team on corporate staff. We build out a lot of our own tech, and then we partner with companies for best in breed. So think of us kind of like a hub and spoke model from a technology perspective. And then I think the biggest thing for us is our culture. And that's, if somebody was to ask me the thing we do better than everybody else, it's that, because we're not trying to take everybody. So we're very intentional about who our franchise owners are. We're very focused on community. Our people are not about just selling houses. It's about how we interact with the communities that we serve. We have a website that we're very proud of where we share stories of the clients that we work with, called humansoverhouses.com. It's been a very significant mantra of our company for a long time. It's about putting people first. So we're not trying to be the biggest company. That's not our goal. We're privately held, but we are absolutely trying to be a company that is very professional, very community focused, and just really trying to raise the bar of professionalism in this business. So it's been a fun ride. We've grown to over now 630 locations. I would say that the best part about my job is getting to see, over 1,000 people in a conference room or, during our annual conference, and just the energy of what we've put together is really, it's what drives our organization, and it's cool to see what we've built. So,
a lot of your franchise locations are in more rural areas, correct?
Yeah, we have a very big footprint. So because our model is designed around, you don't have to grow to a certain size, you can be as big or as small as you want. We have offices that are quite large, and we have offices that are just a husband and wife that, you know, sell 50 houses a year. They're the, you know, top agents in an area, and they work from their home office, or they have a small location. So we've modeled it in that it works extraordinarily well in rural America, as well as, you know, in big cities, which is why for such a young company, we have such a significant footprint. Arguably, we have one of the largest footprints of any company in residential real estate for one single brand. So
what are the specific challenges or, you know, benefits of being in those more rural locations?
Well, I mean, our model is designed to be more affordable than most. And so we create a much larger national footprint / referral network because of that. A lot of times the rural markets can't afford some of the larger brands that are, you know, well known, and the cost for doing that. So we've designed it to be something that a team can now own their own office and not have to operate on an expensive model. Or an independent could come over. I'd probably say 80% of our offices or teams or independent operations that join the company. Probably 20% is existing large businesses or franchises that leave one brand and come over. So we have a very different niche than I think a lot of our competitors do. But that advantage is really simple. When you're part of a bigger brand, it becomes recognizable, and that means something. It's why, you know, if you go to a stay in a city somewhere, you get out of your hotel room, you've got Joe's coffee shop on the left and Starbucks on the right, you'll go to Starbucks because you understand what you're going to get, the same overpriced burnt cup of coffee that you get anywhere else. So like, the point is, people recognize brands, they enjoy, people like consistency. And certainly we're bringing that to markets that are harder to get into based upon, you know, typical cost of franchising, whereas we're a more affordable option than others. So,
you know, one of the things that has come up in the commission lawsuits and is now everyone's talking about is like, what is the value of a buyer's agent? What does that look like? So you're talking about, like, you know, you want to grow professionalism in this industry. You know, tell me what you think the value of a buyer's agent is in this particular market.
I don't even think it's this particular market. I think it's been what a buyer's agent's value is all along. Look, I wouldn't be me if I'm not direct about stuff. Our industry has sucked at articulating our value to buyers because we haven't had to. And this decoupling is going to cause us to become more professional. The irony of it is, I could have a room of 1,000 agents and ask them this one question and always get the same answer. And I'll say, how many of you think that working with buyers takes more time than working with sellers? Raise your hand. Everybody raises their hand. It's like, my next question would be, then why are you not having them sign a buyer rep agreement when you require your seller to do it? And the room kind of goes like, you know, some states require it, but remember, like, 36 states don't. So it's a question you have to think about. And my answer typically is, I don't think agents have ever actually learned how to articulate their value on the buy side. They've told buyers that the seller is going to pay my compensation. So I'm going to help you through this process. And we haven't had to learn that muscle skill of communicating that, but I'll go the other way with it. So I have some data that no one's seen before, because I'm involved in a new venture called Raise. So it's RAYSE, just in case somebody wants to look that up. And it's where we've actually started tracking what realtors do in a very finite detail. And it's fascinating to me, because the Wave Group did a study on, buyers asking buyers what they think the average amount of time an agent works for them when purchasing a house. And over a majority of those buyers said less than 20 hours. Ironically, the data shows the opposite of that. The average agent will spend between 80 to 100 hours working with a buyer. I really think about that for a second. If the consumer thinks it's 20, but it's really 80 to 100, that's a big disconnect. So I always like to point this out. When you are going to tour a property, and this is an exact example of time, by the way, the listing agent or the buyer's agent is going to call the listing agent, have a conversation, maybe set up a showing, ask some preliminary questions, drive to the property, spend 45 minutes with the buyer, showing the property, going back to the driveway, having some discussion. Do you want to get the copy of the disclosure package? Yes. Now they call the listing agent back, get a copy of the disclosure package. The buyer's agent sits down and reads that disclosure package, which, by the way, in California might be 126 pages. That's not an hour. That's 6 hours worth of reading to do. On one property that the buyer might not actually do anything with. Multiply that times 10 or 15 houses, and you have a significant amount of time. The irony behind this is the lawyers in all of these cases, they're just completely about money, are talking about we should go hourly. Lawyers can do it. If you paid a lawyer, and I know this for a fact that lawyers do not because I've seen this data. If you want to pay a lawyer the amount of hourly rate they charge and the same amount of time that they would spend as a buyer's agent, the buyer will pay more. Period, the end. So we just have to get really good at that transparency part so that buyers go, wow, I had no idea my agent was spending that much time. Candidly, that's what Raise has been developed to do. And it also applies on the sell side. When buyers and sellers actually see what we do, they stop questioning our value. Here's the other comment I'll tell you. And this I think is so important because it frustrates me. Buyers and sellers think we get paid the gross commission, the bulk amount of the compensation. Why are we not explaining to the buyer how our business operates? I work for a brokerage. I have to pay part of that to the brokerage for insurance and operational costs and liability costs and all of the things to operate my business like any other company. By the way, I'm a 1099 independent contractor. I don't get part of my money sent to the government, paid by the company. I have to pay all of it to the government. So I've got to take 30% out and pay the federal government, unlike you, where the company pays half of that for you or your Social Security. I also have operational costs that go into it. And when you take all of those things out, or by the way, I was referred to you by Zillow, so I have to pay a 40% referral fee to them as well. We're down to 30% divided by the amount of hours. If you look at the amount of hours that an agent actually works and divide that out, 30, 45 bucks an hour, maybe.
And, you know, I think that your average person, because they don't buy a house all the time, some people don't buy a house ever, they don't know. And so, but on the other hand, you have all these, you know, $1 million listings and, you know, Shaws of Sunset and all, just the kind of like amazing, like, oh, these glamorous real estate agents. And so I think that they can often feel like, oh, they're just making all this money. Of course, there are people who do. There are luxury agents or top agents who might do that. But the vast majority, as we've seen through all of the data that we've looked at, you know, your average agent is not even making $50,000 a year.
But even this, so I have some very good friends who sell very high-end real estate, like, you know, $50 million properties, $75 million property. They're in the 1% of the 1%. And I asked them, like, you know, what do you spend on marketing costs? And they're like, well, directly for the property or like what it takes to operate this business. And let me give an example of that. So they go, we don't prospect for these types of clients. We are at very high-end social functions. We're meeting them at events. We're at different clubs that are very expensive. We're at different parties that are very expensive to attend. They classify all of those as business expenses in order to meet these clients. So when you look at, they're like, well, they're at this high-end social club that costs $250,000 a year to be a member of. That's actually where they prospect. That's a business expense. So like my point is, even in the high-end side of these things, it doesn't matter whether you're working, you know, bread and butter America or luxury, your expenses change based upon the client that you're trying to affiliate with. Now, I'm not saying that luxury agents don't make a lot of money. They do. But my point to that entire conversation is, transparency is important because you don't know what you don't know. And then people make assumptions very quickly. So it's the assumption of the agent made $30,000. No, the agent didn't make $30,000, actually. When you break all that down, they made this. And the buyer goes, well, I didn't even know any of that. And as soon as you get them to go, I didn't know any of that, they stop questioning.
Well, and I think that when you're transparent about this is what I'm actually doing, and also figuring out how to help them know how many hours you're doing it, or, you know, like being more transparent there.
Activities, yeah. Expenses.
And then on the other side, also explaining that, like, there's, you know, people don't want to work with the buyers themselves. I mean, we could all go out there and represent ourselves in some ways, right? But nobody wants to do that.
Well, nobody has the time. This is such a great comment, by the way. I'm doing this opinion piece that's going to come out, breaking down all of the false and headlines from mainstream media that have been so completely inaccurate, it's ridiculous. If you look at FSBOs, so for sale by owners, they peaked at 15%. I forget the amount of years. It's a long time ago now. And they just bottomed out at 7. If the cost of selling real estate was too expensive, then why hasn't the FSBO market grown? I mean, it's a fair question, right? Like, why isn't that getting bigger then? If everybody's sick and tired of paying realtors, then why is that number continuing to shrink? My theory is this. So in 1966, dual income households in the United States was around 30%. Now it's above 66%. What that means is it's so expensive to live that mom and dad, my house, both have to have jobs. We both have to have an income. We've got a three-year-old, thanks COVID. Like, all these things are happening. And so we're so busy that, like, the last thing I want to do is go, hey, we need to move. So here's what I want to do. We're going to sell our own house. We're going to do our own loan. We're going to hire our own moving U-Haul, and we're going to do all. No one does that. And then it comes down to this constant debate of, well, there hasn't been options. Give me a break. Do you know when Help You Sell was originated in this industry? 1976. I wasn't born yet. Help You Sell has always been a lower fee model of help you sell. It's what kind of things do you want us to help you with? So this Redfin has been around since 2004, I think. Like, it's this whole concept that there hasn't been options. It's been, you know, it's been this consistent number. It's just a complete lie. It's a complete lie and has been since the first moment any lawyer said it. So to me, it's that we just have to start articulating what we do very clearly. We have to explain and give people options. If somebody wants to do something for $39.95 and I'll list and sell your house, great. That's not a new model. There are plenty of companies who've been doing that for as long as I've been in residential real estate. The consumer will choose. I just happen to think the reason why consumers want it completely taken care of is what I just said. I think people wake up, they go, I want somebody to handle this because it's stressful. The comment that you made earlier, it's infrequent. We're going to do this maybe three times in our life. And I just want this stress taken care of. I don't want to have to make choices of, I want to pay for this and I don't want to pay for that. Most Americans don't think that way. That's why you pay more money to have DoorDash food than the food cost itself.
So true.
Convenience.
So let's talk about, you know, because obviously one of the things that is under fire here, and one of the things that's going to change is just the way that realtors are tied in with the MLS system. Right. And that, I mean, this is one of the main advantages we see. We also, it's one of the things that came up in the trial, in the Sitzer Burnett trial and other things where people are like, well, now that we have Zillow, we don't need, you know, I mean, how hard is it to be a buyer's agent? You know, I can find the home by myself, all these things. Tell us a little bit about how you look at the MLS and what you think, you know, how this changes going forward.
So my take is I don't think this fundamentally changes much. I'm going to be counter to a lot of people freaking out. In fact, if you just think about this, on March 15th, that settlement happened with NAR. The only thing that changed in a realtor's day, effective July, for actual, you know, realtor-owned MLSs, is the fact that you can't put the offer of compensation in the MLS. That's it. Nothing else changed. You can still talk to a seller. You can still grab a percentage amount. You can still offer compensation to the buyer's agent. You could still offer a concession, which we could do previous to the settlement. There'll be a new field in the MLS called seller concessions. I guarantee you'll see all the MLSs implement that field. So the seller can offer a concession directly to the buyer, or you can collect the money and pay the buyer's agent. The buyer's agent can simply call you, be like, is there a compensation being offered by the seller? Yes, there is. It is going to remove what the Department of Justice wants and what the plaintiffs want, which is the their view of steering. I think the vast majority of realtors do not do that. There is always a small percentage of people that do not follow the rules, including lawyers. And so the biggest goal of what the DOJ wants is to remove steering. And they'll have accomplished that with this. I've had people ask me this morning, do you think the DOJ is going to intervene? I do not. First of all, I don't think Ketchmark negotiated a settlement without talking to the DOJ. He's not stupid. Number two, the DOJ has been very clear about what they're looking for. They want a buyer's agent to sit down with a buyer and agree on compensation for the services that the buyer's agent says they're worth and the buyer agrees. I, by the way, have no problem with that. For what it's worth, I have no issue with that because I think good agents are going to charge more, and I think bad agents won't be here. Fine. So that is the point: is that the buyer agreed to compensation with the buyer's agent, irrespective of what the seller's offering. So there's no steering any further. That's agreed upon. So now from there forward, every house would be treated the same. Now, there's certainly going to be concerns. This is essentially where the change does come. This is the part where NER is extraordinarily important. And I have been very, you know, vocal about the things NER does well, and I've been critical about the things that they need to do better. Their communications department needs a lot of work, a lot of work. However, NER is incredibly important to this industry because there's one piece that has to be added into this equation for the industry to move on, and it will continue to do what it does today. And that is the ability to finance the buyer's agent's compensation into the loan. And there's only one organization that will be able to pull that off, and that is the National Association of Realtors. And they will pull that off because they have a tremendous amount of advocacy power in DC. It's an election year. There's a lot of things that this thing did that doesn't help VA or veterans. That's a topic we should be putting front and center. It's going to hurt minorities. It's going to hurt low-income people as well. And if you have this situation where a seller decides they don't want to offer compensation, and every offer that comes across has a stipulation in it because the buyer can't afford to pay their buyer's agent directly, a stipulation that the seller pays the buyer's agent's compensation. If one of them is at a lower amount than the other, then theory that buyer could be losing out because of representation. That is why the one final piece of this equation, financing compensation into the loan, which can be done, all it takes is an act of Congress to tell Fannie and Freddie to do it, then the buyer can choose how they want to draft their offer. And if they don't want to have the seller pay it to be competitive, they can choose to finance it. To me, that's the only part of this equation. Otherwise, you could currently today, as you will in July, you could stipulate that the buyer, that the seller pays the buyer's agent. You can ask for a concession. The seller can offer compensation through their agent to the other agent, just not on the MLS. They can offer a concession directly to the buyer as long as it's not related to buyer's agent's compensation. This is not sky's falling. And I have the complete faith that NER will come through on that final piece. And we are moving forward as we always have, only better in my opinion.
Optimistic view there on not no shade from me on NAR, but just the fact that you think that anything can happen in the current environment in Washington.
I think it can, because this is why. You have an election year where both, I don't think any American's happy with either choice, but both choices are trying to get elected. It only takes this. You have to put pressure on Congress to make this change so that they tell Fannie and Freddie to make these changes. That's literally what it takes. Fannie and Freddie will not do it without Congress telling them. If 1.5 million realtors, this is what I would do if I was in charge of comms at NER. I would rally 1.5 million people on two issues: that right now the plaintiffs and the Department of Justice are screwing veterans and they're screwing low-income and minority Americans across the country. And that's exactly how I would state it publicly. And I would show the exact reasons why. And the solution to this is to do the following. So that, and I would make a massive campaign around it, just straight out calling out Washington, D.C. for what has occurred. And you watch how fast one party wants to pick up those votes. So to me, this is not complicated. It just isn't. Everyone's overcomplicating this. We need to dump the $60 million realtor ad budget that's being spent into that. That these policies are screwing veterans, which nobody in America ever wants to be part of that organization, part of, you know, screwing veterans. And we're screwing minorities and low-income Americans as well. Watch how fast that bill gets written to change those policies, and we're done. I'm not kidding. That's as simple as it takes. Because if you're being elected right now, what do you not want? You want votes. You don't want less votes. Biden literally last week opened his mouth when he shouldn't have and dragged the industry into it when it's obviously he didn't know what he's talking about. But he literally said that the settlement was going to lower, you know, cost of housing. No idea what he's talking about, obviously. And 1.5 million realtors should be pissed at the president for saying that. This could be a way for him to counter what he just did by actually advocating for things that help a constituent. So I don't think it's that complicated. And I do think people want votes. And I think the right message will cause it to occur.
So say we get that through. And Fannie and Freddie are now like, yes, you can finance this. I mean, you still come down to the fact that, say, especially for a VA borrower, right? So all of a sudden now you can finance that, but I mean, your debt to income ratio might be off. You're, you know, now this is more than you can afford on a monthly basis. It doesn't completely solve this problem.
It becomes a negotiation tool. Correct. And that's the final part, is it's a negotiation. And if the seller wants to sell the house, then they have to come up with something in the middle. And there's going to be some movement in there. It could be that a seller pays part of it, buyer pays part of it. Could be all or one or the other. Like, there's going to be some room in that process. I don't think this removes a realtor from the equation. I think that we're going to adjust. I think that there's a lot of communication that needs to occur from listing agents to explain to a seller that, look, this is a veteran. This is what it is. This is their, I mean, this, we do love letters all the time. Like, this isn't anything that's new. So there's going to be better negotiation that needs to occur in this. Do I think there'll be some pressure on buy-side compensation? Potentially, depending upon the market and the agent. I think there'll be agents that charge more. I do. I'm that optimistic. Because right now, if you think about the current system, the seller's agent chooses the compensation. Like, just fundamentally think about that for a second. So the seller's, however good the seller's agent is with the seller, dictates for the most part what the buyer's agent's going to be paid. Well, in this new world, that's not being dictated. I can sit down with a buyer and say, this is what I do, and I'm going to do it for X, whatever that might be. And it could be more than it was originally being paid by the seller's agent. So I genuinely think good agents are going to do better. I think mediocre agents will struggle. And I don't think Americans just decided overnight that they don't want to use representation. By the way, two most common ways to get into a lawsuit for a seller, which is why the system was structured this way: unrepresented buyer. They didn't understand what they were purchasing. They didn't understand the disclosures. They didn't understand contingencies. They sue. And that cost is a hell of a lot more than paying compensation to have representation, by the way. And the second one, which is going to be one of the effects of this outcome, is dual agency will increase. And if you talk to any insurance company, which I've talked to many, they do not like dual agency, because it is also one of the common reasons why lawsuits occur, because somebody felt like they got screwed because there was bias in the experience. That's why 9 states currently outlaw dual agency. I also think that will be a growing topic with the DOJ at some point.
I do too. I think that dual agency is in some ways just putting a target on your back.
It is. And we just created more of it.
Yeah. I still think that at the end of the day, VA buyers are screwed. Low income buyers are screwed, because we saw in 2021, we did a whole story on the fact that, like, you know, those applications, if you have a competitive buying environment, if it's a seller's market, those applications already were going to the bottom of the pile. So if now you have the option to, as a seller, sell to someone that you don't have to pay their agent, or you have the option, like, you're going to have to, because they can't afford it, you're going to have to come in. I mean, they were going to the bottom of the pile, even when they weren't costing anybody any money.
How do we solve that?
I don't know. How do we solve that?
I do. It's a simple answer. We need to build more housing. It's really that simple. We're 7.1 million units short of housing, depending upon the source you talk to, of housing in this country currently today. The biggest problem Americans are facing is the fact that housing is too expensive. And it's not from the realtor's compensation. Right. Like, I had this conversation with somebody the other day. It was the stupidest conversation I've had in a while. They're like, well, if the seller doesn't have to pay buyer's agent compensation, then the cost of the price of the house will go down. What are you talking about? Like, that is not how that
Zero
works. Like,
that happens. Zero chance.
That is not how that works. They're going to keep it at the same price that they were. Like, they're not just gonna be like, well, we don't have to do this, we're going to lower the price. It's not how that works. So the way we solve the problem for a huge amount of issues in this country, we have to get aggressive on making it easier to build housing. We have to get aggressive on zoning laws. That's local, obviously not federal. We have to figure out how to make some of the environmental laws more relaxed so that it's cheaper for builders to build housing. I'm not trying to irritate anybody by saying this, but that's fundamentally the problem. And we need to do it in a way where we don't crash housing prices, because the largest way to generate wealth in this country is through housing. But we're 7 million units short, so we can overbuild for a while and we should be okay. If that's what needs to happen, it's a two-pronged approach. Again, I would be advocating that extensively, and I would be putting some of these safeguards in place to make sure people can finance compensation. But you're not wrong. There's a lot of Americans who can't afford to buy a house in this country. And it's growing.
It is growing. No argument for me there. James, thanks so much for being on. Really interesting conversation. Yeah. Can't wait to have you on stage at the gathering in April, talking about some of these very same things with a lot of other smart people. Can't wait to do that. Thanks for being on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Truly appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Housing Wire Daily. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to take a minute to rate the show and leave a comment. And make sure to tune in tomorrow for more news and insight.